Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio from NPR, with the support of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Art Silverman, and our show today is about Poland. We call it Poland, a ghost story. It's about the battle against the Germans and the Russians at the start of World War II, and about Poland's battle to fight years of environmental poisoning during the Soviet era. In the summer of 1989, I went to Poland with a reporter and an engineer, 50 years after World War II began. The reporter was Alex Chadwick.
Not all the war is in books now. Not yet. A character from the war, a man too unimportant for a place in history books, has agreed to a meeting at a train station in the city of Freiburg in southwest Germany. He comes into view walking stiffly on bad knees. His face is gray and yellow. He doesn't breathe the way he should. "I am sick," he informs anyone. "I think I will die in a year or so." Seeing him, you would think this is likely to turn out to be correct. Willie Lawrence, on that day 50 years ago, was among the first German soldiers to enter Poland, a distinction he bears without any sign of pleasure in it. We go to a small outdoor cafe in the yard of a church on a mountainside in the Black Forest.
Gestern hatte ich's noch gesehen, aber jetzt nicht mehr hier.
Even though it's 2 hours before noon, the old man orders a beer. We unfold a map across the table and look for one of the places where World War II began.
What's that you're looking for on the map?
I'm just looking for the place where I crossed the border from Germany, from East Prussia into Poland.
When was that? What day was that?
The 1st of September, 1939.
The very first day of the war.
Yeah. Wir sind vorher an der Grenze hin und her marschiert seit 17. August.
Yes, that was the first day of the war.
These events that Willie Lawrence recalls are from August of 1939, when Germany burned with a fever and Europe feared contagion. Many people in America and elsewhere guessed at what Hitler might be. Already he persecuted Jews. Already he bullied his way into Austria and Czechoslovakia. Now he pressed Poland. But those who despised Hitler worried that trying to stop him would lead to war. Then in that month of August, as the 30s closed, the Germans achieved something fearful, a deal with Stalin. The Soviet leader had been thought by most observers to be a sworn enemy of Hitler and maybe a useful counterbalance to him. But suddenly, the two countries signed a pledge not to attack each other for 10 years, relieving Hitler of one important potential enemy. Quickly, Britain agreed on a treaty with Poland, one meant to keep the Germans from adventuring against their neighbor. Then everyone waited.
The last 2 weeks of August were probably the most beautiful fortnight I've seen in Germany.
William L. Shirer was an American reporter working in Europe for most of the 30s. When the war ended, he wrote the most popular history of it, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. But when it began, he was a radio man for CBS in Berlin.
It was rather warm, and there were days when it was rather sultry. But the Germans in Berlin, for example, loved to go out on a weekend. The places filled with lakes. So you had this sort of contrast of them going through the things that they liked to do. Hiking, swimming, sailing, boating, that sort of thing. And a fear, they had a fear that it might come to war.
A lot of the national boundaries in Central Europe looked different then than they do today. On a map from that time, you'd see Germany and Poland about where they are now, two good-sized countries beside each other. The main difference was that part of what's now northeast Poland, a big area, was then German. It was called East Prussia. When diplomats at the end of World War I were redrawing borders, they cut East Prussia off from the rest of Germany by giving Poland a narrow strip of land so that it would have access to the Baltic Sea. This was as though Nevada got to build its own road to the Pacific, dividing California in half. Hitler demanded a way to East Prussia that would be under Germany's control, a corridor that would bisect Poland's own corridor to the Baltic. He also insisted that Danzig be declared German again. Danzig was what we now know as Gdańsk. Founded by Poles, it had been occupied by the Germans for a long enough time so that many of them regarded it as rightfully theirs. But after World War I, the city was made an autonomous international site, although it lay within the area granted to Poland. In August of 1939, the reporter, William Shirer, went to Danzig to look for signs of what would happen.
I got up to Danzig about 2 weeks before the war started, around the middle of August. And I remember after two or three days there, saying to myself and writing in my diary one night, what am I doing in Danzig? This is not the cause of the war at all. It became evident to me by the middle of August, I think, that Danzig was an excuse, that Hitler wanted the destruction of Poland as an independent state, as he had wanted the destruction of Czechoslovakia as an independent state. He was using Danzig, which all the Germans wanted back, whether they were Nazis or anti-Nazis, and the solution of the corridor.
It was at about this same time that Willy Lorenz waited on a ship in the German port of Szczecin. Hitler was getting ready for the invasion. Willy's unit was going to attack Poland from East Prussia, but the Germans couldn't send troops there by land. Instead, they would go by ship, heading up the Baltic coast.
Wir fuhren an einem herrlichen Sonntag
frühmorgens. On a wonderful Sunday morning, we traveled on a ship, a steamboat which had until now just been used as a tourist ship.
This is from an account of that time, which Willy wrote after the war.
Sahen uns viele Segler, Ruder, die dort ihren Sonntag verlebten, und einer rief zu.
On the boat trip, we passed a lot of people who were sailing and rowing in the Stettin harbor, and one of them shouted, "See you again in Poland." There was always some kind of adventure on this ship, because the ship's crew said that there will be a war between Great Britain and Germany. We didn't care about that so much. There were other interesting things. We were packed with cheap cigarettes and rum, which we had bought in the duty-free shops. So we drank and smoked a lot. That was the best thing we did.
Ohne Steuern und Schnaps ohne Steuern, und so ging unser letztes Geld für diese Versorgung drauf.
Willy's voyage took 2 days. When he arrived in Prussia, he and the other men with him were sent down to a place on the Polish-East Prussian border. Very soon, William Shirer's fears would be proven right, and Willy Lorenz would be among the first Germans to invade Poland as history began to spill over its banks.
You're listening to Poland, the Ghost Story, from Hearing Voices, the best of public radio.
I was broadcasting from Berlin, and about just as I went on the air, say around midnight, the German news agency, DNB, rushed somebody into the studio, and it was a text of Hitler's proposals to Poland, which he said the Poles had turned down. These proposals from Hitler, there were something like 12 points, were extremely reasonable. The reason it was reasonable was because the Poles had never even seen it. It fooled me that night I broadcast, but I went on the air and I said, well, these proposals look to me very reasonable. And if the Poles are willing to discuss the situation on the basis of these, we're going to have peace. My God, this was on the night of August 31st, and within 10 hours, the German troops were marching. They'd been ready to march for several days.
But it was not until after the war that the reporter learned the details of what actually happened the next morning, when at 5:30, Hitler announced, "We're now shooting back." That's what he said. The Germans claimed Polish soldiers rushed a German radio station at the town of Gliwice, near the border in eastern Germany.
They pulled a typical sort of Nazi stunt, I would call it, which we only learned after the war at Nuremberg, and that was that they had a number of SS men dress up in Polish uniforms. They dragged a few poor souls out of a concentration camp and drugged them. So these SS men attacked the radio station and shot these two or three civilians getting in. And Hitler used that in a speech the next day at the Reichstag, saying the Poles shot first.
While the Germans staged their trick on the morning of September 1st, the real invasion, that of the German army into Poland, was already underway in many places.
We had to tear down houses and take the lumber from them to build bridges.
Willy Lorenz was a soldier in the Pioneer Corps, a unit of the German army that went ahead of the regular troops to build bridges and open roads. Early on the morning of September 1st, he stepped into the shallows of a small river that divided German East Prussia and the Polish town of Korsela, about 100 miles north of Warsaw. The Poles had blown up the only bridge there. Willy Lorenz and the others in his company were to quickly put in a new temporary replacement so the German army could attack.
And then we had to be in and out of the water all the time, and there was always the danger of getting shot. It's interesting, as long as nobody was wounded and you hadn't seen how somebody was shot, we were hardly frightened. As newcomers, we were more courageous than later when we had been through some rough times.
And this, from notes made after the war, this is what Willy Lorenz recalls of that day when he and the others, directed by Hitler and the German General Staff, started World War II.
We had to build a bridge to replace the old bridge, which had been blown up, clean up the rubble from the old bridge, and then build a permanent overpass. I was supposed to go in the water to lay a cable. In doing so, I came across a shell crater in which a dead Polish soldier lay. I was repulsed. In agonizing pain, I came to realize I had seen the first dead person of the new war.
There is no border at Korsela today. There's no more East Prussia. All the region is now Poland. But this is still a remote farming area where horses pull wagons loaded with hay way off down hours of small roads. There's a regular bridge again over the Orzhitz River. And in the village of Korsela, there are still a few people who remember what happened 50 years ago, the stunning speed of the German advance, the desperate efforts to escape.
Bombs were falling everywhere. Terrible things were happening.
Were these things that you heard about or things that you saw?
I saw everything myself, how people were bumped and their guts and parts of their bodies were everywhere. So we ran away as fast as we could to the forest, to holes in the forest to hide.
Irena Kornatska, who was 18 when the war began, and she fled from Kortsela with her brothers and her sister and an uncle. They walked, pushing a bicycle loaded with everything they could get on it.
We
went barefoot and carried our shoes in our bags.
Why?
Because when you have only one pair of shoes, you want them to last as long as possible, because you don't know when the war will end.
But what could be more important than using your shoes to help you run a long way on the first day of the war? That's the best day to make a lot of distance.
No, because we didn't know what would happen, so we went barefoot. But when we came back to our village later, we put them on, because we knew how far we would have to go.
Całe ogromne kolumny i na te kolumny zwykle nadlatywały samoloty niemieckie.
Refugees were streaming south in enormous columns. German pilots bombed and strafed them. Of course, they had to know they were civilians, but that was the way the Germans fought in that war.
Ryszard Juszkiewicz, a retired judge, and since June a Solidarity senator in the new Polish parliament. But back then he was an 11-year-old boy who lived near Kortsela and saw the world turn upside down. His family ran, but the roads south to Warsaw were so crowded with refugees that it was hard to get away. The Polish army used the roads too, repositioning troops and rushing supplies to where they were needed. The Germans were always nearby.
To, co charakterystyczne, to pamiętam, że kiedy uciekaliśmy z nadgranicy...
I remember one day we were running from the Germans and we came to the Polish defense lines. And the refugees were streaming with all their belongings and farm animals. There was mooing and whinnying horses, a terrible mess. Children crying, women crying, their possessions piled up on horse-drawn wagons. All the dust and the sun beating down on the people on these awfully congested roads. It looked like the end of the world. That reminds me of something else. Earlier, sight of a galloping Polish cavalryman covered in dust and brandishing his saber. He dashed past us in a full gallop, and we admired him because he was a man who might just have clashed with the Germans, because his saber looked blood-covered.
All this shock and fright on the first and second days of September, 50 years ago. And it was not just Poland that reeled. At last, the British recognized they could no longer ignore and appease the Germans. On the third day of September, England's ambassador in Berlin went to see Hitler's foreign minister, von Ribbentrop. Historian William Scharer.
It was revealed by and then there's Schmidt, who was Hitler's interpreter. And Schmidt tells about the British ambassador coming to the Foreign Office at 9 in the morning. He'd called up the Foreign Office and Ribbentrop had said he was too ill to receive him, but the Schmidt would receive him. Henderson read him the statement that at 11 o'clock, if the Germans had not agreed to retire their army from Poland, there would be a state of war with England. Schmidt then rushed into Hitler and told Hitler the news. And he describes, I think, Ribbentrop was standing in the chancellor's office looking out the window, and as if the thing had happened which he had told Hitler would never happen, that the British would agree to go to war. And he turned to Hitler turned to Ribbentrop and said, a very simple German expression, "Was nun?" What now? And Ribbentrop turned to him, and all he could think of saying was, I expect the French to come in 6 hours later, which they did. And from Smith's description of the room, later on he said, as he went out, Goering was standing at the end of the room, and Goering said, God help us if we lose this war. So there was there wasn't that optimistic feeling that you might have expected when they realized it was going to be a world war and not a Polish campaign.
And so the world war began. Poland held on for a while longer, but the Germans couldn't be stopped, not in Poland anyway. Planes and tanks led a charge of mechanized modern warfare, much faster than anyone had realized was possible. They raced past the refugees, and they told them, turn around, go home. And many of the Poles did, because there really wasn't anything else to do.
This may sound funny, but what I can recall is that as soon as I got back to my house, I started making a wooden model airplane.
Richard Juszkiewicz, the 11-year-old from near Korcela.
It was a big model resembling a kite. I couldn't find thin paper, so I just used wrapping paper, and I was surprised that this plane wouldn't take off.
What kind of, was it a model of a military aircraft?
Nie, to był taki ogólny, można powiedzieć.
That plane was a kind of projection of my dreams. I had seen so many German planes and so few Polish planes. And my building of that model plane was my way of reinforcing the Polish Air Force.
He was back home building a wood and paper air force, even before the end of September. The steel and horses of the real Polish army were hardly more effective. Within weeks, Poland would cease to exist as a state.
Poland, the Ghost Story, our story about the way World War II began, will continue with Alex Chadwick telling us about the terrible days in Poland as German troops advance, and he'll look at the terrible condition the river and the air of the country found itself in 50 years after that war. You're listening to Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Poland, a Ghost Story from Hearing Voices. We've been following a German foot soldier's story of his small role in the first days of the invasion of Poland in August 1939. His name was Willie Lawrence, and he recounted his tale in the town of Freiburg in 1989 on the 50th anniversary of the start of the war. Alex Chadwick picks up the story.
There are monuments all over Poland to the courage displayed in the first weeks of September 1939. In a city north of Warsaw, called Mława, for instance, the Polish defenders held out a lot longer than they should have against the far better equipped and prepared German army. These were doomed heroes, and they knew it. In Mława, as elsewhere in Poland, There was very soon no doubt as to the outcome of the invasion. What people did not know was what would happen next.
We were taken up into Poland to watch the final thing.
William Shirer, the historian and author who would write The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich after the war. In 1939, he was a radio reporter for CBS stationed in Berlin. He'd been covering Europe for most of the 30s with a growing sense of despair. He'd visited Poland in August and come away discouraged at the Poles' lack of readiness. Shortly after the invasion began, he went back to Poland with some other reporters, supposedly to watch the fall of the Polish capital.
We were told that we would be taken to Warsaw, where Hitler would triumphantly enter and make a speech. The speech was shifted to Danzig, and I'll never forget that. It was held in the old Guildhall there, and Hitler came down, followed by his usual party of about 10 or 15 thugs and ministers and so forth. And he brushed me like this, hit my arm. He had a look of fury on him. So there was some party guy standing next to him. I said, "What's the matter with the old man?" And he said, "He's been in a terrible fury. He'd been sitting outside Warsaw for 3 days waiting for surrender. So he's had to come up to Danzig." And I've seen Hitler in many speeches, but never seen him in such an angry mood as he was that day.
Had Hitler waited a few more days, he could have had that Warsaw platform he wanted. 2.5 weeks after the Germans marched into Poland from the west and the north, the Soviets launched their own invasion from the east. 10 days later, Warsaw surrendered. And Poland, having suffered defeat, began to experience Nazi occupation. Willy Lorenz is now in his 70s, a retired union man living on a small pension in southern Germany. He is a lifelong socialist, he says. He was always against Hitler. Nevertheless, when he was drafted into the German army in 1938, he went. Willy was assigned to the pioneers, road clearing and bridge building troops who went ahead of the infantry. A year later, in 1939, Willy Lorenz was in on the invasion of Poland from the first moments of the first day. He came under fire and he saw men from his unit die, and saw many Poles killed too. But the German invasion was so swift that in less than a month, Willy's unit was no longer needed. They had traveled no more than several dozen miles, staying all the time in the region of small farms and old villages north of Warsaw, where they had first crossed into Poland.
Der letzte Einsatz war eben vor Warschau mit diesen spanischen Reitern und mit dem...
We did our last job just before Warsaw, where we put up blockades and dug some trenches for the infantry.
And when would that have been? That must have been right before the fall of Warsaw.
17... Moment... Es war nicht richtig, wie es in der Propaganda heißt.
I can't remember the exact date. The invasion took longer than 18 days. 18 days was the official version of the propaganda. The invasion ended at the end of October. After that, we rested in Makow, and we lived alongside the village people there.
Und in engem Zusammenleben mit der Dorfbevölkerung.
3 months ago, at an outdoor cafe in the Black Forest in southern Germany, Willy Lorenz found the town of Makow, spelled M-A-K-O-W. He found it for me on a map. It was an unimportant-looking dot 2 inches from Warsaw. This was where he said he was garrisoned soon after the invasion began, and where he stayed for about a month before returning to Germany.
Nichts mehr gemacht wurde, nur noch ein bisschen Ordnungsdienst, also exerzieren, aber keine Übungen.
We didn't need to do any military duties. We just had to march once in a while. It was totally quiet there, and we could do what we wanted to do.
Waren uns viel selbst überlassen.
Was this the time of the... I guess this must have been harvest time.
Yeah, that's also...
We helped them with the potato harvest.
2 weeks after recording this interview, I was in Warsaw, knowing nothing more of Makow than what Willy had told me. But prompted by curiosity to see the place, I drove there. It took 2 hours in the rain. And it looked like the other villages I passed on the narrow roads. Maybe it's because Poland is poor, and this part of it especially so. But everything seemed old. There were small fields without tractors. And then the little places with names difficult for a foreigner to pronounce. And the materials that made up everything. Simple and plain. Wood, brick, plaster, stone. Makov is big enough to have a church, but that's hardly a distinction in Poland. Children crowded around to see a stranger with a tape recorder. They showed where to find the priest, and I asked if he knew anyone still living there who'd been in Makov when the war began. And he took me to Dominika Wilachowska. She was 28 back then, a farm girl who left the farm and married and became a hairdresser with her husband. They had a child, a boy. On the 1st of September, 1939, a German plane bombed Makov to scare people, Mrs. Wilachowska said, because there wasn't anything there of military use. She said this sitting in her dining room, which had the quiet, empty feel of some place that isn't used anymore. Mrs. Wilachowska is a widow now. The most valuable thing she has left is a beautiful, soft crown, gray-green felt hat she bought for her handsome husband long ago. After the Germans bombed Makov, when they all ran for their lives, she took the hat with them because she couldn't imagine ever again spending so much money for anything like it. They fled south toward Warsaw for several days, but the Germans were much faster. They passed the refugees on the roads and ordered them to return to their villages. And so Dominika Wilachowska turned back to Makov, and this is what happened.
The soldiers themselves weren't so bad to the refugees. In fact, the ones that I met while I was on the cart, they were quite decent.
I heard a story from a German soldier who was in this area who told me that some soldiers were pulling Jews out of the lines of the refugees and beating them. Did you see that kind of thing?
No. I didn't see them beat them. I only saw them when they hanged them.
You saw them when they hanged them?
Yes, I saw it when they hanged them. I went to see it for myself.
When was this?
It was when we came back to our hometown after running away. It was all sometime in September.
How many Jews did they hang here?
18 or 19, I don't remember exactly.
18 or 19. Were they men or men and women?
Men.
Were these people who you knew when you went to this hanging? Did you recognize the people they were hanging?
Yes, I recognized them. It was in a big square. I went straight there, then went around to look at it. They were kept hanged there for a long time. I remember how they dangled on the ropes. They didn't take them at once from the ropes.
Did they hang them all at once or hang them one by one?
Yes. I saw them hanging in a row. I didn't see them when they were being hanged. I saw them already hanging.
Wasn't it dangerous to go?
It was dangerous.
50 years ago, Dominika Wilachowska set out from home to walk to the other side of town. Her husband warned her not to go. I was brave, Mrs. Wilachowska says now, remembering. And she was. She didn't hide from the soldiers. I'm just going on an errand, she thought. She walked along, looking at the ground in front of her, but watching off to the side. The Germans had hanged the Jews about noon on scaffolds they had their victims construct. It was 1:30 or even 2 o'clock when the hairdresser circled the plaza and saw what was there, the dead men still on the ropes. She walked back home a different way than she'd come. Something terrible was happening, and not just to the Jews. Within days, the Germans took 20 townsmen, selected without any reason anyone in Makov could understand. They took them to a hill outside of town, and they shot them. This place, where 50 years ago it was already apparent what was to come, this place among other places where the war began, this execution ground where the Jews were hanged in unfamous Makov, is today the village bus station. There's a big, open, asphalted area with a building at one end and a little covered place where people can wait. At the other end is a weedy patch of ground and a memorial to Makov's Jews. There were hundreds of them before the war, maybe 1,000 or more. There was a synagogue here and a cemetery for the Jews. All gone now. The stones from the cemetery remain. The Germans smashed them once, and either they lay undisturbed in pieces at the site, or someone put them away somewhere. After the war, the stones were cemented back together and made into the memorial, arranged so that 50 or 60 of them form each of the four sloping walls of what looks like a small, dark, closed house. Jewish burial stones carry on them symbols that relate something about the person's life. There was a man who made bread. There was a woman who kept a family. And in all the stones and the carved designs that tell the circumstances of lives past are the fissures and marks from that time when the stones were broken, the ruptures and cracks and repairs still visible in every one. A bus stopped in the plaza, and two schoolgirls got off and opened umbrellas against the slow rain. "Do you know what happened here?" I asked. "Yes," they replied. "There was a cemetery or something for the Jews." "Do you study the war in school?" "We'd rather not. There are special schools for those who want to study history, but we'd rather not." The question of history, of retaining the memory of witnesses to an event perhaps like no other, was something I'd raised 2 weeks earlier when I spoke with Willy Lorenz, the German soldier who had stayed in Makov.
Do young people today like to listen to your stories about the war? Do you tell your children about them?
No, not often. They hardly ask, and they're not really interested, because they think it's useless to them. The youth of today are trained to be efficient and career-oriented. General knowledge, including history, is not that important anymore in Germany.
Willy, you say today there is no general, broad study of history in Germany, of what happened in Poland 50 years ago?
Aber nicht in der Intensität und nicht...
Yes, but they don't do it intensively. It's too superficial. People don't want to go into details.
"I will die in a year," Willy Lorenz said. He promised that before he did, he would write a letter to say a few more things. I don't know what secrets the old man is saving, but in 2 days of interviews, in stories from what he said was an unhappy time in an often unhappy life, he never mentioned what really occurred in Makov. Of course, Willy was not among the German soldiers who carried out atrocities. There were special units for persecuting the Jews and others. Willy was not among them. Still, in the month of September of 1939, Willy Lorenz must have known what happened at Makov and must have guessed what it meant. And 50 years later, he is still too ashamed to tell it. And for that, who can say that we should blame him? What I think I'll remember most from Poland is something I heard which had nothing to do with the origins of World War II. Here it is. It's the beginning of the Vistula River at a place way up an old logging road in the Carpathian Mountains in the south of Poland. The stream is clear and cold, but all along the way of the river, towns empty sewage into the Vistula. And mines operate in these mountains. And where they do, they often fill with salty water. And this, too, is pumped into the river, 8,000 tons of it each day by some estimates. And steel plants and nitrogen fertilizer plants and lead smelters and zinc smelters, all of these drain wastes into the Vistula, most of them with completely inadequate treatment if there are any pollution controls at all. At last, the Vistula reaches Kraków, the old Polish capital, the city of Polish kings. The surface of the water is flat. It looks slow-moving. But a man in a rowboat works to keep his place. A woman watches the murky river from a bench near an excursion boat. She remembers when she could swim in it. Before it got so dirty, she no longer even wanted to walk along the bank. It's not just the river, she says, but also the city, which is dying. It's so polluted, small kids are getting sick here. Krakow is said to be among the most beautiful cities in Europe. In the center of the oldest part, carriages for hire still go down narrow, old, carriage-sized streets that run between medieval stone buildings undamaged by the war. Through luck and circumstance, Krakow escaped the bombers, but it's been less successful in confronting progress. Many of the city's monuments are being destroyed by the polluted exhaust from nearby factories, so acidic that in a few decades, the features of statues which stood for centuries have dissolved. There is a story told in Krakow, one of many folktales about the river. A long time ago, before even the castle of Polish kings was built nearby, a dragon lived in a cave on the banks of the Vistula. Once each year, it claimed a young maiden from the village. At last, a cobbler thought of a plan. He took a sheepskin, and using his tough cobbler's needle and thread, he sewed the skin back into sheep shape, and then filled it with sulfur, which even then was being dug from local mines. And he left this work near the entrance to the dragon's cave. Just as the cobbler expected, the dragon swallowed the dummy sheep in one bite. But when it reached the dragon's belly, it broke open and out spilled the huge ball of sulfur to bubble and boil and burn. Then the dragon leaped into the Vistula and began drinking the river until the creature drank so much water that it burst and was gone at last. And so Krakow, the first capital of Poland, grew up beside the river that was the instrument of its salvation. Chopin's city, Warsaw, the present capital of Poland, and another city of the Vistula. It's about at the halfway point as the river flows to the Baltic. Officials say that by the time the river gets to Warsaw, enough of the chemicals dumped into it from industry have settled to the bottom so that the river is drinkable again. Warsaw takes its water from the Vistula. Really, there's no alternative. This is what people say about the water: that it's safe to drink, that it's not safe to drink, that it may be safe if it's boiled. In Warsaw, the capital of the country, people simply don't know whether it's all right to drink city water. And in Warsaw, government officials agree the condition of the Vistula is very serious, but they say Poland faces so many serious situations, including almost $40 billion in foreign loans which must be repaid. Eventually, they say, Poland will restore the river, but it will take much longer if the country has to act by itself. The authorities hope Western governments might help with the loans if Poland uses the money it saves to begin controlling its pollution. Sweden is helping already because environmentalists there think cleaning the Vistula in Poland is the most practical way to save the Baltic Sea, which they share. But also in Warsaw, a professor and former official tells me all the studies about coming environmental doom are based on presumptions that the worst is bound to happen. Not necessarily, he cautions. Nonetheless, the view of the Vistula from its banks at the northern end of the city is not encouraging. Here, the Queen of Poland is a stinking, dull hag. A Polish science writer, Krystyna Karwicka-Ryszlewicz, offered to show me the shame of the city.
Attention, please. Can you wait? Because it's unpleasant.
The writer is the domestic editor of the Polish journal Technology Review, a distinguished magazine published for 125 years. She's been covering the environment in Poland since the early 70s, and she's seen a lot. This morning, she picks her way through a mucky area near the river stream. There's a dense, matted scum where the river water had flooded and then settled back to its normal level. Warsaw, she says, is the only European capital which does not have any treatment plant to clean its sewage. This year, finally, a plant is opening for some of the waste from the part of the city that's on the other side of the river, just a small part of it. It's taken 15 years to build that.
Nazywa się Czajka. Dziennikarze mają po prostu radość z tej nazwy, ponieważ mówią,
the name of the plant, she says, is Czajka, which is a kind of water bird. Journalists like to say it's a bird which cannot fly. The plant, she says, is a failure. It's already obsolete. The air by the river is heavy and dank. Thick pieces of the stuff underfoot stick to shoes. But at last, we come to what Kristina Karvika Ryshlevich has promised, a place where one of the underground sewage canals empties right into the Vistula. The mouth of the canal is at least 20 feet wide. A gray, oily stream pours out from it, and where it enters the river, it widens out from shore in a clear divide from the muddy brown already there, almost as though the Vistula shrinks from contact. The writer points at what is floating in the water, and the substance of the scum that covers the riverbank with the city all around is plain to see.
Shit.
You know, I was talking to a man in the water manager, and he said, in fact, the problem is over-dramatized. He says, really, it's not that bad.
To wobec tego szkoda, że pan zanim że pan nie zadał mu pytania.
It's a pity you didn't ask this man why it is that all the hot water heating pipes in the buildings have to be replaced so often. It's because the water is so harsh it destroys the pipes, she says.
Ja mogę jeszcze moment powiedzieć o takim zdarzeniu sprzed.
May I refer to something that happened 3 years ago, she asks. Perhaps you don't know what can be found at the bottom of the Vistula.
Mianowicie w okolicach Płocka, na przestrzeni 25...
Not far from the town of Płock, all life was killed along a 25-kilometer stretch of the Vistula. The perpetrator was never caught.
Że przyczyną była próba pogłębiania dna Wisły.
But the scientists concluded that an attempted dredging operation on the river bottom caused the slaughter, because it stirred the poisons, and that's what accounts for the deaths.
Tak zwane toksyczne dno jest prawdopodobnie w całej...
There's a toxic river bottom throughout the whole country, Kristina Karvika Ryshlevich says. Out of Warsaw, the Vistula bends west and then north again through the low, rolling country that stretches to the Baltic 200 miles away. 670 miles from the mountains where it begins, the Vistula enters the sea at the port of Gdańsk. It's raining. Most students have already finished exams. This is a Saturday anyway. The University of Gdańsk is nearly deserted. But eventually, I find the Medical Institute building and go upstairs to keep an appointment. With a casement window pulled shut against the downpour, the lecture room is quiet. There are three ecologists present, a medical professor, a retired sailor who's on the Solidarity Ecology Committee, and Gerald Kaptur, an official from a nearby port who works for the Ministry of Maritime Transportation. The fishing industry, he says, is almost gone. The Bay of Gdańsk is badly polluted, mostly from the Vistula.
At first died in the Bay of Gdańsk the eel, because eel is protected only by chemicals. He has no scales. And eel is living at the bottom of the sea. There is the biggest chemical contamination. And for this purpose, the eel was the first fish which died in the Bay of Gdańsk. The second was flounder. And now we can find eel caught, herring. In practice, all fishes living in the Bay of Gdańsk are now mostly eel.
When you go to the authorities and say, this doesn't make sense and... This does not discourage, these kinds of fines don't discourage people from polluting. What do they say?
They said about this problem is under preparation.
They're preparing a law?
Well, but the preparation is going on approximately 14 years.
Indeed, the seven countries that surround the Baltic Sea signed an agreement back in the 70s, committing them to start real efforts to save the sea from destruction. Of the seven, the ecologists say, Poland has done less than any in beginning the work that's needed. But then, Poland is the poorest. In the evidence ecologists cite to support demands that something be done right away is this fact. Studies show a greatly increased incidence of mental disorders among children in some industrial areas of Poland. It's from the lead particles from the smelters, scientists say. So it's a poignant coincidence the next morning to get on a tour boat going across the Bay of Gdańsk and find a group of kids from a school in Warsaw and another group of adults. We pass a tall, elegant, double-jointed crane which digs into an enormous open mound of mustard-colored sulfur and then swings out above a ship's hold. A fine slick of yellow dust covers the water all around. where our wake churns, the water looks like oily brown Coca-Cola. In 2 hours, we cross the western end of the Bay of Gdańsk and at last arrive at our destination, Hel. Hel's a very small place, spelled Hel, one L. It's a seedy-looking tourist town way out at the end of the thin peninsula that makes the Bay of Gdańsk. Yellow smoke comes out of the chimneys of the houses along the few streets, and the air smells of cinders. The tour stays only 1 hour in Hel. Poles come to Gdańsk to be tourists because so much has happened here. It's where the Germans first fired on a Polish garrison to start the war 50 years ago. The tour boat goes right by that place. And it's where Solidarity began. And now many Poles think they see a vision linking those two events, a free, independent Poland, missing since the war, and not quite apparent again yet, but increasingly real. Even if this is achieved, there are things that have happened in the intervening years that will probably take at least another half century to make right. And the ruin of the Vistula River is among them. As we are about to re-enter Gdańsk Harbor, we come upon a dredger working near the end of a long jetty. Somewhere below, a hose is sucking at the bottom. The machinery screeches and groans with its load. Huge steel jaws on a circulating belt are choking full of a dark pus brought forth to the surface and spat out into a barge. The sad collection of passengers watches from a railing at the side of the tour boat until we pass the dredger and go into the harbor again. This is Alex Chadwick.
You've been listening to Poland, a ghost story from Hearing Voices. I'm the producer, Art Silverman. The recording engineer was Linda Mack. We had help in Germany from Karen Breslau and in Poland from Jan Sank. Our website is hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.